Hello, I'm Dr. Sonal Kumar. Thank you so much for joining us for the Glow Up Era of MASH Management. This initiative is supported by an educational grant from Novo Nordisk Incorporated. This is the third of four CMEO snacks in the series. Today's episode will address FDA-approved MASH-specific therapies, which we now have two of. Again, my name is Sonal Kumar. I'm an assistant professor of medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York, New York. I have both a clinical and research interest in patients with MASLD and specifically within multidisciplinary care. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by Dr. Zobair Younossi, who of course needs no introduction, but I will ask him to introduce himself nonetheless. Dr. Younossi?
Hi, Sunal. It's wonderful to be with you and to be a part of this wonderful program. I'm Zubair Nasi. I'm the professor and chairman of the Global NASH-MASH Council. I've been in the field of liver disease research and specifically in the sort of area of NASH or MASH for about 30 years, doing different types of research, including outcomes research, epidemiology, clinical trials, and IT sort of assessment, et cetera. So I'm delighted to be here.
Great, looking forward to our discussion. So here's our learning objective for today's program. After participating in this activity, learners should be able to better identify available MASH-specific therapies appropriate for timely management in concordance with treatment guidelines and care pathways. So let's get started. Today is the third in a four-part snack series following the case of our patient, Mr. B. So we'll start with just a little recap of Mr. B. He's 61 years old, the utilities field crew chief. He was seen just for a routine follow-up visit, didn't really have any complaints, no abdominal pain, fatigue, no pruritus, no history of jaundice. His pertinent medical history includes type 2 diabetes, dyslipidemia, and hypertension. He's also overweight with a BMI of 29.1. As far as alcohol consumption goes, he has an occasional glass of wine with dinner. And the medications that he's on right now, metformin, valsartan, and hydrochlorothiazide. His physical exam was unremarkable. And then when looking at his lab values, his liver tests were all essentially normal. Just a couple of things to point out. Bilirubin was one. His platelets were 110,000. And then his cholesterol LDL was 130, triglycerides 235, and then A1C was 7.1%. So first step in his assessment was to do primary risk assessment. So he had a FIB-4 score, and the FIB-4 score was 2.59, which puts him in the indeterminate category. He also had an abdominal ultrasound just to make sure nothing else was going on. It showed hepatic steatosis. No real hepatic lesions, no ductal dilatation, no ascites. Because his FIB-4 score was indeterminate, then he had subsequent secondary testing. First, he had a FibroScan, which was 9 kilopascals, but the IQR was a little bit on the higher side of, and so he had further testing with an MRE, which showed a score of 4.2 kilopascals. He also had an ELF score of 10.2. So essentially confirming MASH with fibrosis. So before we get into the discussion, let's get the audience involved. Which of the following would you consider for treating Mr. B? A, lifestyle intervention only, so just using nutrition and exercise. B, resmetirom. C, semaglutide, D, resmetirom and semaglutide, or E, I'm not sure. And there isn't necessarily one correct answer to this question. So let's talk about our option. So Dr. Younossi, would you agree that this is this patient with type 2 diabetes who is eligible for MASLD and MASH therapy. And if you agree that this patient should be treated, would you choose which therapy would you choose and why?
Yes, thanks, Sunal. So there are a few things that when you look at this patient, even before doing NITs, that should raise sort of some issues. First of all, you've got a patient with three components of metabolic syndrome. That's dyslipidemia, diabetes, and hypertension. The male. And then you look at the labs, despite the fact that the liver enzymes are normal, his platelet count is low. This suggests to me advanced liver disease. So even without doing a FIB-4, you know that you're dealing with a patient that has high suspicion of having advanced liver disease, or at least advanced fibrosis, not advanced liver disease. So now, of course, that was confirmed with FIB-4 followed by a transient elastography. But I think when you have a patient like this as a secondary NIT, I wouldn't just I wouldn't stop with just one secondary NIT because you want to make sure, absolute sure, that the patient doesn't have cirrhosis because currently the drugs that are approved should not be used in patients with cirrhosis. So doing a second NIT here, they have done three NIT secondary NITs, which are VCTE and then MRE and then ALT test. All of those suggest that the patient has probably F3. So because this patient has F3, now if the ALT test was more than 11.3, or if we had a VCTE of 20 kilopascal or higher, then I would say that patient probably has cirrhosis and I wouldn't treat. But here I think you could treat pretty reasonably consistent with the current guidance. Now the question is, what are you treating? So the first thing to do is that regardless of what drug you're going to use that will target MASH, you have to use sort of lifestyle issues, address that the patient probably should consider some form of exercise. And as you know, these patients also have some sarcopenia from time to time that you want to address. So both sort of physical activity, both in terms of muscle sort of resistance, as well as other type of cardiovascular sort of improvement will be important. And looking at the diet to make sure that ultra processed food is really not included in the diet and exclude those would be one way to do this. But then you have a treatment of diabetes that's probably not optimal in a patient like this. So the patient is on metformin. And metformin, we could get into this a little bit more, probably is not the ideal treatment of diabetes in this patient. Probably I would treat the comorbidities of diabetes and obesity. I mean, he's overweight, at least with a GLP-1 agonist. Now the question is, if he's on that treatment, should you also start the other drug that's approved and that's been approved for over a year, which to me is resmetirom. So he certainly is a candidate for resmetirom also. What are you start them both at the same time? It's sort of a flip of a coin. And if the patient can actually tolerate and the insurance, the payers cover both, I don't have a problem with starting these shortly, one after each other. I wouldn't start both drugs all at the same time because I don't have the evidence to say that tolerability. I'm not too concerned about side effects of hepatotoxicity, but I am concerned about tolerability, especially with the GLP-1 receptor agonist sort of GI side effects. So if I have to start something, I may start resmetirom, or I may start semaglutide, but very shortly after that, I probably will consider both for this type of patient, because that's really the ADA guidance that was published earlier, or guideline that was published earlier this year, and also the global guideline or recommendation we published in gastroenterology this past month would recommend that you treat the comorbidities, and then you also have targeted treatment for MASH. And the patient that has F2 or F3, and the patient has F3.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think in patients, that I suspect have a little more advanced disease, like more towards the F3 side, which I would argue, like you said, this patient, his platelets are low. He has multiple comorbidities, especially with diabetes. I tend to be a little aggressive with them, and I will start, like you said, stagger them, but be quick to start both medications. And then which one you start first is sort of a toss up. I completely agree.
Yeah, absolutely.
So here are the FDA indications for the two approved MASH therapies in the US. So what we have available. So first there's resmetirom. Resmetirom was approved in March of 2024. It's indicated for treatment of adults with MASLD and MASH with moderate to advanced liver fibrosis, so stage 2 to 3 fibrosis. And it's to be used in conjunction with diet and exercise. And the big trial that led to the approval of resmetirom, the phase 3 trial, was the MAESTRO-NASH trial. And they looked at MASH resolution and improvement in fibrosis and found that patients on resmetirom had higher rates of MASH resolution with no worsening of fibrosis compared to placebo, and greater rates of at least one stage fibrosis improvement with no worsening in the MASLD activity score, again, compared to placebo. So this was the first drug we had available for treatment of patients with MASLD and MASH. And then in August of 2025, we have semaglutide getting FDA approval for patients with MASH. Again, similarly, it's approved for patients, adults with non-cirrhotic MASH with moderate to advanced liver fibrosis, and to be used in conjunction with diet and exercise. And the phase 3 trial that led to the approval for semaglutide was the ESSENCE trial. And during that trial, they found that a greater proportion achieved a reduction in liver fibrosis with no worsening of steatohepatitis compared to placebo. So those are the two medications that we have approved. But, MASLD and MASH, and we're alluding to this with diabetes and comorbidities, obesity, et cetera, is really, a metabolic disease and very closely related to other metabolic processes. And that holds true for pharmacotherapy as well. So there are multiple medications that have been studied that have liver and cardiorenal effects, particularly in the glucose lowering medications. Do you ever make recommendations to use specific medications for diabetes?
Yeah, and I think if I have a patient, to be honest with you, most patients who come when they come to see us, at least in my practice, for consideration of treatment of MASH, they order the oral GLP-1 receptor agonist for treatment of either diabetes or obesity. So it's to me, it's really to consider something else. So I think there are some patients that may not have approval for treatment of for your use of GLP-1 receptor agonist for treatment of obesity that now can qualify because semaglutide is approved. So for treatment of diabetes, I mean, going back to the ADA's guidance, the recommendation is you can use a lot of things. You can, for patients with early disease, you have probably a lot more options. With patients with very advanced disease, like decompensated cirrhosis, you really only have insulin. But for someone like this, for treatment of diabetes, you can use a GLP-1 receptor agonist, dual agonist, pioglitazone. Although a lot of hepatologists have sort of stayed away from pioglitazone, I don't see why. But for someone like this, I think the choice of treatment of semaglutide or using semaglutide as treatment of choices is a to me is a really a no-brainer. And the reason is that it has shown to improve cardiovascular outcomes, kidney outcomes, heart failure. It has now with there is evidence and approval for treatment of steatohepatitis. So you have and the risk is of hypoglycemia is pretty low. If you have to use something else because the patient can't tolerate it, any GLP-1s, then you can use other drugs. You can certainly use pioglitazone or SGLT2 inhibitors. I probably would prefer those than the other drugs in this context, but of course that patient has to be on treatment with resmetirom. An F3 patient cannot wait for whether these other drugs should have evidence. Now, pioglitazone, as you know, There has been some studies, small studies, and there is meta-analysis of these small studies suggesting potential benefit. But if you want to go for an FDA-approved drug, then we have resmetirom or semaglutide. Pioglitazone is very cheap, but I think the semaglutide and resmetirom are the one that are recommended by all the guidance and guidelines, at least the liver guidelines and guidances for treatment of steatohepatitis. If someone is on tirzepatide for treatment of MASH or treatment of type 2 diabetes, then would I actually change that? Probably not if the patient is tolerating, because I know there is phase two clinical trials suggesting tirzepatide would be good for steatohepatitis, but it's not approved yet. But I think we certainly have resmetirom to add to that patient's regimen. So I think the choice would be based on the stage of liver disease, based on what patient can tolerate and what the insurance covers. We have a good number of options. I would stay away from metformin, not because I think metformin is terrible. I don't think it is. I would not use sulfonylurea in this context. And insulin, I only really reserve insulin for patients with decompensated cirrhosis because that's the only one that you can use.
Yeah. How do you feel about the SGLT2 inhibitors? Are those your go-to after semaglutide or the GLP-1?
Yeah, I think there is significant cardiovascular and kidney benefit. I mean, especially in cardiovascular side, that's the number one cause of death in patients with MASLD. However, it's important to remember that that's for all patients with MASLD. If you get to a patient like this patient, F3, it's not cardiovascular mortality that's number one cause of death. It's liver mortality, the number one cause of death. There is some early suggestion that this may also have benefit in the liver side, some non-invasive tests, especially hepatic steatosis. So if I don't have other options, I will use SGLT2s, but knowing that there will be some sort of extra hepatic benefits, as long as I can use resmetirom for that patient, because that's also that's the drug of choice for a situation like this.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, it makes it a lot easier now that we have resmetirom approved that we can use these, some of these other pharmacotherapies that and then add on resmetirons for more like liver-directed therapy,
Yeah,
especially
exactly.
in the patients with more advanced disease.
Agree completely. What do you use, Sunal, in terms of what's your choice of treating? Say, do you treat all patients with MASH and diabetes with a GLP-1 receptor agonist? How do you manage dyslipidemia? Do you use a combination of things? Do you use statins? Do you worry about statins?
Yeah, I mean, now with semaglutide having the MASH indication, that's sort of become our go-to. But like you said, a lot of these patients already come in on a GLP-1 by the time they come into our clinic. Or if they're not on a GLP-1, there's a reason why they're not on it. But you always have the handful of patients that, like this patient in this scenario whose diabetes isn't properly controlled, and then the GLP-1s are or the dual agonists are definitely my go-to for that. I have some people who don't tolerate a lot of medications or insurance issues for whatever reasons, and I have a few that are still on pioglitazone, and they tend to do okay on it. But now with resmetirom being approved, I just add on resmetirom for that liver-directed care if for some reason they need the pioglitazone. As
I
far as
agree.
dyslipidemia, I'm a huge proponent of using statins in patients. There's a lot of data that shows that they're safe for people even in cirrhosis. The only patients that I'm really cautious about are those that have more decompensated disease, and those need to be closely monitored, low dose statin, things like that. But otherwise, I don't really have a problem with using statins in these patients.
And I think that's wise, and I think that's what we do as well. And the other thing, of course, is important is that there is now more and more evidence that hypertension is actually another predictor of bad outcome in these patients. So managing hypertension will be really important in this context. Is that what you also sort of pay attention to the more and
Yeah.
more these days? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let me ask you another question. I think that's not specifically for, or it could be related to the treatment. Do you rule out historical alcohol consumption is very, very poor. People underreport, or they just forget, or they just don't want to talk about alcohol. Do you, and now we're using more and more PET testing, which is a test to sort of a biomarker for recent alcohol use. Do you use PET testing for all your patients with MASH to and what is your cutoff? What cutoff do you say? Okay, well, this patient has methyl ALD or ALD, and then what do you do then?
So I mean that's a little bit tricky. I mean the first question's easier. So yes, we do test for PATH. We test PATH every time a patient comes in if they consume alcohol. And usually, if they even if they say no, I will do a one-time PATH level because I have uncovered people who even despite saying no alcohol consumption, they have a positive PATH level. So I at least do a one-time test, and then if it's elevated, I will do I'll follow it over time. But then, it's hard to decide what level of, what PATH level do I say, okay, more, this is probably alcohol more than anything. I kind of take the whole history into account because, patients with uncontrolled diabetes, severe obesity, et cetera, like they're at higher risk for the MASLD complications, even if they have met ALD. And I tend to still treat them based on their cardiometabolic comorbidities. And we have providers within our clinic. We actually have a multidisciplinary alcohol clinic as well, the CALM clinic here at Cornell. So I will sometimes patients will follow in my clinic and in the CALM clinic simultaneously to help. And there is some data in the GLP-1s that they do reduce alcohol cravings. And so I think that can be helpful. I think the patients that I tend not to treat, if it's pure alcohol use disorder, then they go on to our alcohol clinic instead.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I think it also illustrates the fact that MASLD, methyl-LD, and ALD is just part of this dynamic spectrum. I call them dynamic spectrum because and these patients can move back and forward because people can actually drink and stop drinking, binge drink and then stop drinking, or improve their diabetes, or lose weight, gain weight. So this is not a static situation. So you have to sort of be ready to sort of adjust it. The good news is that there is data on resmetirom that the efficacy was not impacted when you look at sort of MET-ALD sort of analysis. Pure alcohol-associated liver disease is extremely rare in the United States because when you look at patients with ALD, 90% of them have at least one cardiometabolic risk, at least one. Either it's because cardiometabolic risk factors are so common in this country or in the world, or alcohol causes obesity, causes dyslipidemia, induces all these metabolic abnormalities. So finding pure ALD, usually the pure ALD are younger patients and they have, alcoholic or alcohol-associated hepatitis. And you're right, they should be treated differently. But most of the other ones should have sort of a plan to address their metabolic abnormality. Now, if there is actually alcohol-associated liver disease and they stop alcohol, some of the metabolic abnormality, they could lose weight, they could actually improve their dyslipidemia. So there is not an urgency to address that, but I wouldn't forget about the fact that these patients may actually be treated. And MET-ALD, if I'm a patient with MET-ALD, which is moderate amount of alcohol consumption, and they have a cardiometabolic risk, I have no problem using one of the two approved drugs at this point. Well, I know it's approved for only for MASH fibrosis, significant or advanced fibrosis. But to me, those patients still need to be treated. You would address the alcohol consumption at the same time. I would treat not only the metabolic comorbidities, but also use a liver target treatment.
Yeah, completely agree. So we talked a lot about pharmacotherapy, and it's very exciting to have, two drugs relatively newly approved. But we, both are approved for being used in conjunction with lifestyle recommendations. And I always talk to my patients and tell them that these medications are not a replacement for lifestyle changes, and they really have to make changes to their diet and exercise. Dr. Unathi, what are you telling your patients in terms of, do you talk to them about weight goals, how much to lose? You know, there's data showing that at 5% you start losing 5% weight reduction, you start losing steatosis, 10% to improve fibrosis. Are you talking to your patients about that as well?
Yeah, and I do. I think that there is a very important concept here is how to actually communicate this information to the patient. Because telling a patient go and lose weight and come back and see in 6 months, that's absolutely ineffective.
That won't work.
You've pioneered some of these metabolic clinics. We have a multidisciplinary team, and I think that's how you have to approach it. And you have to approach weight, lifestyle recommendations the same as a prescription, meaning that you have to educate them, you have to actually provide them with goals and monitor them and bring them back and have actually folks who are trained in this sort of treatment. So yes, we talk about those who have who are obese or overweight, 10% weight loss is really what we hope to do. And for those who can't lose the weight and are candidate for bariatric procedures, certainly that's an option. And as you know, bariatric surgery will if the patients lose weight and improve diabetes, they will actually improve everything in terms of steatohepatitis. But even in those patients that have normal weight, I mean the so-called lean muscle patients, I think I would recommend 3 to 5% body weight loss. In terms of diet, it's not just calorie intake. It's not just actually okay, go and use go and actually start using Mediterranean diet. Let's actually stop talking about the name of the diet. Tell them what this means, that you're talking about, the component of what is in Mediterranean diet. That's one thing. The other thing that I actually tell them is to really stay away from ultra-processed food and also from, high refined sugars. Those are the kind of things, beverages and things like that. Stay away from those. Alcohol, I do tell them to minimize alcohol, and especially if there is any fibrosis or especially significant fibrosis. And the reason is that when you look at patients, the even smaller amount of alcohol can actually have a detrimental effect in the liver from a liver standpoint. We also know there's data on cancer side of things, but on the liver side. So in this situation, I would recommend alcohol sort of limitation. Finally, exercise. I think it's important to recommend the exercise that sort of regimen that's supported by American Sport sort of medicine association, sort of 75 to 150 minutes of exercise per week. But also don't forget about resistance exercise. Like I said, these patients can have sarcopenia. At least there's a theoretical chance that GLP-1 receptor agonist can cause sarcopenia. So having good nutrition, improvement of muscle, but also exercise would be critical. And if folks are interested, to go back to the global consensus recommendation that came out in gastroenterology last month, there is a nice figure and that you see, and it's pretty easy to follow these.
Great. So we talked about appropriate medications. We've talked about lifestyle modifications. Now, what about the intraprofessional team? So this is a figure from the ADA guidelines for MASLD and people with type 2 diabetes. So the care team really varies according to how the risk assessment for the patient. And I think this just stresses how important it is that we do appropriate risk assessment in our patients, because how we intervene or who the appropriate team members are varies according to that. MASLD affects 30% of the population, but 30% of the population cannot be, unfortunately, in the hands of a hepatologist. So we really need to select out these high-risk patients. How are you working with, other team members, especially? I mean, we always knew this was a metabolic disease, but now there's so much overlap with pharmacotherapy and things. How should providers coordinate? Or do you have any recommendations?
Yeah, no, this figure is a beautiful figure, and I'm a member of the ADA guidance and guideline committee that was part of this, and I have to give a lot of credit to my colleagues and endocrinology side, and there were about three or four of us hepatologists that were part of a large group, because that actually provide very good guidance on what to do for earlier patients with F2s, F0s, and F1s. I mean, these patients can be managed by their primary care physicians or endocrinologists wherever they want. If they have metabolic issues, and of course, lifestyle is the key. If there is actually diabetes or other component of metabolic syndrome, you want to reassess them. So I would reassess those patients with just a FIB-4 in a year. If there is no cardiometabolic risks, then you can reassess them still maybe in 3 to 5 years rather than just every year. For the patient that need to be seen by hepatologists is really the cirrhotic patient, the patient that have cirrhosis. Because even if you want to do a lifestyle intervention, you just have to be careful not to cause some nutritional issue for these patients and worsen their sarcopenia. And that is critical. And then make sure to screen those patients for hepatocellular carcinoma because they're at high risk for that. And also when the need is for liver transplantation and to make sure that they're in transplant setting. They sort of in the middle group, which is basically these patients with moderate to some, advanced amount of fibrosis. This is where the multidisciplinary team would be absolutely critical. You need to have a hepatologist or their APPs, but whatever this is done within a single center, which I think what you are experience that you have experienced, or you could put this in sort of a virtual where you have component of this sort of a multidisciplinary team coming together, I think would be critical. And I'm a believer that hepatologists should be involved where they need to be involved, of course, in all of these things, but our advanced practitioners need to be involved in every step. And that means APPs from GI and hepatology, APPs from endocrinology, and even actually in the primary care setting. When we bring this together, I think it would work very, very well. My challenge and our challenge is, Sonal, is that there is not a lot of coverage for things like behavioral health or exercise or nutrition assessment and consultation. So the system, the health system that's a part of, would consider that as a part of a package of how to actually improve the outcome of these patients, they would have to actually consider that because at the end of the day, if you actually prevent a patient death or a cirrhosis, because the cost of taking care of a patient with decompensated cirrhosis so much or NCC, then that would be a big win for the system. And I think these are the kind of things that we need to teach our administrators that this is actually a package that if you actually have to sort of provide some behavioral health as expertise and provide support for that, that you get actually much, much better outcome. And what I call these sort of settings as metabolic clinics, so that the patient come in, they get their eye exam for diabetes retinopathy, their heart assessment, their liver assessment over the FIB-4, and then they're appropriately followed up and connected to the right specialist.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I'm really interested in multidisciplinary care for these patients. And I think one of the nice things with having pharmacotherapy that's been approved now is that there's a lot more disease awareness and a lot more recognition among other providers in primary care, in endocrinology, that MASLD is really a metabolic disease and there is a benefit in care coordination. But I agree, there is not enough support for like dietary, nutritional counseling, behavioral health, things like that, which are equally important to having pharmacotherapy options. And there's so much overlap now that I think there, I agree with you. There should just be a metabolic clinic where they can sort of have a one-stop shop and get their appropriate diseases managed.
Sonal, you've had a good experience with this kind of metabolic clinic. Just tell us a little bit about patients' perspective. I would assume they would love this because we have also, as we're a transplant hepatologist, the transplant sort of care coordination where you've got everybody in the same sort of clinic has always been very, very positive for patients. So tell us a little bit about how patients actually feel about coming together and seeing everybody that matters.
Yeah, I mean they love it. It really reduces care fragmentation. We have an endocrinologist, cardiologist, and hepatologist, and we actually have dietitians as well. And not they don't see everybody on the same day unless they need to. But it's really nice, especially when it comes to management of comorbidities, the discussions about whether the statin is safe or not, you can make the decision right then and there because the endocrinologist is sitting right next to you, or whether or not we need to add resmetirom because they're not tolerating their GLP-1 and they have more advanced fibrosis. Or if you're thinking about starting a medication, to have discussions with it. It's really, I mean, patients love it. It does, you know, it is a lot, little bit longer of a visit. But they have back-to-back visits and then they are able to have a very cohesive care plan when they leave clinic that day, as opposed to, you know, me saying, okay, let me reach out to your endocrinologist. We'll talk, we'll see what happens. And then, you know, there's a lot of back and forth and there's this uncertainty in the patient's mind of what the next step is. I think it's really helpful to for them to know that we're all on the same page.
Yeah, and I think really important. I think one other point that I'd also want to make is that, you know, some of us say, well, you know, the patient, you know, the care should start with primary care. Of course, primary care has to be engaged and involved in everything that we do because that's really a lot of patients with diabetes. Most patients with diabetes are cared for by primary care. And I think they should be a part of all of this. And I have to say that this table was actually created with a lot of inputs from some fantastic primary care providers who are actually part of the committee. But I think this will give you sort of at least a structure of where somebody should be actually responsible for what part of this. Understanding that primary care physicians in the United States, at least, are extremely busy. They don't have time. So we have to come together and make it easy for them. Take those patients that really, you know, they can still be engaged and involved. But, you know, cirrhotic patients that have decompensation probably should be managed by a hepatologist and hepatology team. But it doesn't mean that you should exclude endocrinologists or primary care physicians because there are so many other comorbidities that they are so much more well-trained in that than we are. So I think this concept of metabolic clinic and considering this disease as a part of a sort of a the this you know sort of the galaxy of different sort of metabolic diseases together, I think it's really critical in how we sort of change our perspective because how we were trained as gastroenterologists, hepatologists, we all had sort of these boxes and these lines that they didn't want to cross. Well, for this disease, you have to cross them because if you don't cross them, then you don't serve the patient the best of what you can do.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's about all we have for today. Any final thoughts or anything else you'd like to discuss, Dr. Unasi?
I think the only thing I would say is that it probably would be important to remember that more and more hepatologists and gastroenterologists are staying away from liver biopsy. Even I think in a few years, clinical trials will not require a liver biopsy. Liver biopsy, you know, was good at the time, but we are getting better and better in NITs and or non-invasive tests, and I think would be good. And the one last question I have for you, Sunal, is that do you expect, not just as sort of what we're currently doing is putting, you know, patient comes in on a GLP-1 receptor agonist and we add resmetirom. Are you expecting combination of two or three drugs, resmetirom, semaglutide, or maybe a third drug that's going to be approved as sort of the future? And if you have that, are you going to have that patient treated with two or three drugs, which costs significant amount of money for a year or for forever? And how do you stop?
Yeah, I mean, these are all great questions. So I think, you know, when it comes to combination therapy, we have to think of MAFLD as any other metabolic disease. And sometimes patients do require multiple treatment options. You know, if you look at diabetes, you know, if you look at hypertension, patients sometimes are on multiple drugs and the, you know, one that may work for, you know, someone may have partial response with one drug and then you need additive therapy. So I think combo therapy is going to be in the future. And we're seeing it already. There are people that are on GLP-1s and that are using resmetirom. Even in the MAESTRO-NASH trial, 14% of patients were on GLP-1. You know, it wasn't approved for MASH at that point, but we've seen the effect, you know, some patients on combination. So I think we have to, you know, we have to keep that in our toolbox, that that is a possibility, especially in the patients we think have more advanced disease, because we really do not want those patients to progress. We do not want them to develop cirrhosis. We don't want them to have decompensated disease, liver cancer, et cetera. So absolutely. Now, the question of how, you know, what do we do if they respond or when do you stop the medication? Same thing. This is a chronic metabolic disease, and just like you don't really stop antihypertensives, you don't stop glucose lowering therapy. I don't think right now, I can confidently recommend stopping, resmetirom or semaglutide when it's being used for the treatment of MASH. There's something that led to this disease progression, and they would be at risk for getting it again. But I do hope that the cost goes down. And so, as more and more drugs do become available, I'm hoping that goes down and it's a little more feasible to use multiple medications and keep them on drug.
I completely agree. I think combination is the future. I have sort of this feeling that we will have to treat probably for a year with probably multiple medication. And we all try to actually minimize medication at some point of polypharmacy. So you could consider sort of dropping certain things, especially those that have side effects off your list, and see how can you maintain sort of response with the minimal amount of medication that can be used. And I think that's something we need to see in the future. And the only other thing that I would have to just add to this is that currently the drugs are approved based on the surrogate of outcome, which is, fibrosis and steatohepatitis resolution. We all are going to have to show that these drugs will improve outcome. They're going to reduce more, cirrhosis. They're going to reduce mortality. They're going to reduce HCC cases. Those data are not out there, so but they are going to come. And I have, looking at sort of cardiovascular benefit of some of the GLP-1 receptor agonists, many years later, because these guys in cardiology do very large clinical trials. We have seen actually cardiovascular benefit, kidney benefit, and I'm hoping and I'm positive that we will see liver outcomes benefit in time. And I think both these two drugs that we have available really opened this field for us where we did not have anything. And I think this is really a fantastic time for us because people ask me, well, which drug is better than the other one? Listen, I'm very happy that our patients have now two choices, because over a year ago I have no choice.
Right.
And talking about resmetirom or semaglutide raises the awareness to everyone, and I think it's good for patients, good for providers, and ultimately, well, maybe we will at least make a dent in the in this sort of global epidemic, starting with lifestyle and also with these drugs.
Absolutely. And on that note, I'd just like to thank you, Dr. Younossi. Always a pleasure to speak with you, and thank you for your expert perspectives on the treatments that we have for MASLD and MASH. And thank you to our audience for participating. Before we close, I have just two SMART goals, which are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely action items that you can hopefully apply to the care of your patients in your own practice. So within the next 3 months, increase lifestyle counseling, including nutrition, weight management, and physical activity in combination with pharmacotherapy when appropriate, for patients with or at risk for MASLD and MASH. And then number two, implement FDA-approved therapies with either resmetirom and or semaglutide when relevant in appropriate patients with MASLD and MASH.
Well, thank you very much, Sonal, for including me. This was wonderful.
Thank you so much. And then one final thing, just to receive credit for this activity, just please complete the evaluation and post-test online. And again, please check out the other three snack activities in this series. Thank you and have a good day.
Thank you.